Rohatsu means December 8th. So we've reached Rohatsu. We've reached the middle of Sesshin. Free from the extremes of beginnings and ends. Can't quite find the middle without any reference points like beginning or end. And yet, here we are together, supporting each other to sit like this, to celebrate our great original founder, Shakyamuni Buddha's great awakening. To continue his story from the old scriptures, he's left home, he's learned some meditations from various teachers. He feels he has to go further and goes off on his own. And just continues to try these pranayama methods. Sounds familiar, but it goes on for a while here like this. Buddha says, the Bodhisattva says, I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, violent winds carved up my belly, just as if a skilled butcher were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher knife. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears, violent winds carved up my belly. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. Doesn't seem like it's working out very well. But maybe if I practice it further. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. While I did so, there was a violent burning in my body, as if two strong men were to seize another by arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths, there was this violent burning in my body. So these descriptions are really like, they're descriptions like torture, are they not?
Or Sesshin,
yeah.
Sounds a little like birth.
Yeah, maybe birth, that he set out on his quest to find the unborn, and he's maybe going through some kind of birth process. Painful. Self-torture. I think not even figuratively, but quite literally. Right? I don't think it's just pain for the sake of pain. We have to understand that this is a skilled yogi who's has some strong intuition that this will be helpful to his realization, and very persistent about it too. And maybe just willing to undergo such painful practice. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose did not invade my mind and remain. Now when the deities, the devas, I was hanging around such scenes, when they saw me, some said, the ascetic Gotama is dead. Other deities said, the ascetic Gotama is not dead, but he's dying. And other deities said, the ascetic Gotama is neither dead nor dying. He's an arhat, for such is the way that arhats dwell. There were all kinds of maybe kind of extreme yogis practicing such methods in the old days and the present days. Looking for something beyond. We heard some stories from Francis Cook in Sounds of the Valley Streams about looking at how the difference between Indian Buddhism, with all its stages of purification of karma and klesha and defilements of moral and cognitive afflictions, and compare with Chinese Buddhism that didn't have to go through all this preliminary purification in order to realize some peaceful suchness. That was, you might remember from yesterday, this kind of point, and talking about the sudden. It can be, instead of three eons of practice, there could be a sudden realization. And so Francis Cook goes on, the Chinese deviated from the Indian model in another important way, which was to have a strong impact on Dogen's own understanding of enlightenment. The Chinese rejected the venerable Indian Buddhist view that meditation, or samadhi, meditative concentration, and enlightenment, awakening, bodhi, are two essentially different things, and that meditation had to precede enlightenment. So this is a new innovation of Chinese Buddhism. Early Buddha's teaching talked about sila, samadhi, and prajna over and over in the old sutras. The Buddha says that's the summary of his path. Sila is the ethical discipline, practiced right conduct and harmlessness so that you can settle down and develop a one-pointed concentration of samadhi, so that with this concentrated mind of samadhi, you can then access understanding or wisdom, prajna, and realize awakening. So kind of samadhi is just a method to kind of hone the mind in order to then kind of use the mind for insight. But the Chinese had a little different idea about samadhi here. He says, enlightenment is sudden because when one achieves samadhi, which technically is the state of oneness of subject and object, that same consciousness is enlightened consciousness. This was, I think, a Chinese discovery, an innovation. A number of important Chinese Zen teachers claimed something like this from about the 8th century onward in early Chinese Zen. In other words, And the Platform Sutra of the Six Ancestors is one of these, and others too, where in this one-pointedness of mind and object, which is even in the Indian definitions of samadhi, that's the definition of samadhi. When the mind is, following the breath as the meditation object, becomes so focused on this object that mind and object become one-pointed. Whereas Cook says, this state of oneness of subject and object. But the Indian Buddhists just saw that, well, that's just a method that will precede all kinds of meditative inquiry practices and so on. But here, they thought, wait a second, if there's oneness of subject and object, then there's no separation. And if there's oneness of subject and object, there can't be a subject that grasps an object, which is the root of suffering. So I think it's amazing and new discovery that if we just practice at the moment of practicing samadhi or discovering or verifying samadhi, at that moment there's no grasping because there's no separate subject and object. And therefore, there's no suffering at such a time. It's one maybe basic way of looking at it. And I think this is why starting really in China, maybe before then in India too, but in the Mahayana there starts to become all these different samadhis with different names. And in Zen, they're kind of understood to be all the same thing. They're just one-pointedness of mind and object, but the different names bring out different flavors. So two of our liturgical chants that we chant all the time here are names of different samadhis, right? One's called the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and one's called Jijiyu Zamai. Zamai is Japanese for samadhi. And Jijiyu means self-fulfilling samadhi. So it's not really different, but you can hear in those descriptions of the jewel mirror samadhi and the self-fulfilling samadhi, they're talking about this kind of oneness of everything. And they're not talking about some kind of stage of practice preliminary to a later awakening. Like every noon when we chant the self-fulfilling samadhi, it's like, because you are in the state of self-fulfilling samadhi without disturbing its quality or moving a particle, you extend the Buddha's great activity. And it's almost like not, if you listen to the chant while we chant it, it's not even so much like it's something that you're doing, the self-fulfilling samadhi. It's more like it's the reality that's already happening and we're just kind of according with the reality of self-fulfilling samadhi. So that's kind of definitely a new way of looking at samadhi, a Zen way. It's like that samadhi is itself awakened reality, awakening itself. So Francis Cook goes on, this means, of course, that the process of demythologizing in the phenomenon of enlightenment had started well before Dogen's time. In early Chinese Zen. No longer is it thought that a person must meditate for years or perhaps lifetimes in the hope that this strenuous and single-minded practice would someday culminate in a rare burst of comprehension, unimaginable and almost supernatural. If any ordinary person has great determination and an inquiring spirit and also has a good natural talent for samadhi, that might be a stretch, right? Maybe just something about opening to the one-pointedness of mind and object that actually is the reality all the time. At least in Sesshin, we can even if we don't have a natural ability, which I personally feel like I don't really have such a natural ability for like deep concentration states. But something about a lot of sitting still is might help us to taste the self-fulfilling samadhi that's filling the room and the universe. Or maybe more accurately, taste the room and the universe that's filling the self-fulfilling samadhi. Then enlightenment with some great determination, inquiring spirit, then enlightenment, awakening, the actualization of one's intrinsic Buddha mind is right there at once in the samadhic, it's a Francis Cook word, the samadhic oneness with chopping firewood and drawing water from the spring. Is this the enlightenment of Shakyamuni described and extolled with such extravagant language in the scriptures? Is there something qualitatively distinct up ahead, thousands of lifetimes away? It's hard to say for sure. But at any rate, Chinese and later Japanese Buddhists such as Dogen seem to have been utterly convinced that this was all that was required, according to Francis Cook. It is a nice kind of summary of the Zen tradition in general. I mean, Dogen says other things besides just be the oneness of all things. Like he says over and over, thoroughly investigate this matter, things like this. So maybe there's points to clarify in our understanding as we deepen this unity. So Francis Cook says, what is essential is a selfless performance of actions while united in oneness with the object. What is essential is selfless performance of actions while united in oneness with the object. So there's one-pointedness of mind and object. We also call that non-duality. Non-duality generally could refer to various things, but generally the bottom line non-duality is non-duality of mind and object. Experiences of colors, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, thoughts, feelings, emotions, and anything we could call an experience is not something external to the mind that knows the experience. This is samadhi and is the point to practice, because enlightenment is simply this selfless uniting of the mind and body with its experience. Dogen calls it dropping off body and mind. Experiencing dropping off of body and mind in meditative samadhi, even a little, is the commencement of the ability to live life in an enlightened, awakened manner. If enlightenment is this dropping off of body and mind in the act of totally uniting with some object or activity, it implies that enlightenment is enlightenment for that one activity or encounter, but not necessarily for the next. So, you know, as soon as we leave that samadhi, if we feel there's such thing as leaving that samadhi, then we're back into the appearance of subject-object duality. Therefore, there has to be an ongoing effort to achieve this consciousness in moment after moment of activity and encounter. Once again, it seems that Dogen is not so concerned with some one-time enlightenment, which presumably continues on to pervade all subsequent experience, as he is with the strong effort to evoke an enlightened response with each fresh occasion. So this is why Dogen talks about practice and enlightenment. Practice and realization are not two. If practice and realization were two, as it is for an ordinary person, each could be recognized separately. But it's one moment of practice is one moment of realization. Yes?
It also seems to me that he is demonstrating, not saying, but demonstrating that Buddha nature at one point in samadhi are also synonymous.
Yes, I think that's part of the Zen tradition, that these samadhis, like the dual mirror samadhi and the self-fulfilling samadhi, are not actually just a state of a meditation practice, which is why I might differ a little from Francis Cook, saying we just at the time we're doing it, then we're that's enlightenment, and as soon as we lose that practice, then it's not anymore. That's one way of looking at it. But another way would be like, it's just trusting more and more that we're in that reality all the time. But this is, I think, the great dynamic of the Zen teachings is like, and that's our story for today. Dogen is going to get into this issue. What's the difference then between enlightenment and delusion? Is there one? Or not. But yeah, so Buddha nature is not a temporary experience, that's what the eternally all-pervading true nature of non-dual suchness. So I think that's right, that these samadhis are like another name for that, rather than... I think in Shohaku Okamura's talks on Daigo, a great Satori, he says it looks like Dogen is saying that this is another name for the Dharmakaya. Great Satori. Dharmakaya is just all-pervading reality body of the Buddha. Another name for the culmination of the fullness of Buddha nature. So, also, related to this, as this understanding of enlightenment or awakening evolves, because this reality can't be trapped in one particular conceptual formulation. People are infinitely creative, and cultures are infinitely different, so it evolves, and then that's, I think, part of the beautiful dynamic thing of Buddha Dharma too, is this creative tension of the tradition must keep evolving and changing its expression, even in quite radical new ways, and yet if it's Buddha Dharma, how does it still stay true to the founder and the tradition? I think Zen tradition is the one that really like goes right out to the edge of that as far as they can go, and they still, you know, have this issue of, well, it has to accord with what the Buddhas say, or else it's no longer Buddha Dharma, and we take refuge in Buddha. So, but some people feel like the Zen folks went too far. Some people, even in modern Japan, say Zen is not Buddhism. It's too, this understanding of enlightenment is too different from the early sutras in India. But here in early China, There's a treatise called Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. And it's attributed to Ashvaghosha in India, Anabote Dayosho, one of our ancestors. But scholars say it was probably really written in China. But early on, it was translated by Paramartha, one of the early translators, in about the 6th century, 550 is when it was translated. But that's around the time Bodhidharma came to China. So this is kind of pre-Zen, but this Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana treatise became very influential throughout China, like the Chantai school and the Zen school were influenced by this. And this treatise says, original enlightenment is this term, original enlightenment, original awakening, hongaku in Japanese, seems to maybe be first taught or at least emphasized most fully in this treatise for the first time. I think same meaning, but Hongaku, original awakening, became really important in the Tendai, the Tiantai or Japanese Tendai tradition in which Dogen practiced, and to the point where in Dogen's time things were getting a little bit degenerate, because original enlightenment is everybody already is completely enlightened, so there's nothing. There's no special virtue, practice, or effort required anymore. Everything's it. So the actual practice in the monasteries started to fall apart, kind of based on this amazing ultimate teaching of original awakening. So Dogen, I think, honors the principle of this, but also says we have to make effort to verify this. Exactly. We have to keep fanning. Original enlightenment, the nature of original enlightenment is permanent, eternal. There's no place it doesn't reach. But without fanning, we will understand neither permanence nor the nature of original awakening. So this treatise says it like this. Original enlightenment is the essence of mind, free from thoughts. So like Russ said, like Buddha nature. But now we're calling it enlightenment.
What do you call it, potential?
Potential? I think you could call it potential, but it's like, but it's a potential that's fully, fully manifest. Yeah. But maybe not fully verified, according to Dogen. It's the essence of mind, free from thoughts. It's like the sphere of empty space that pervades everywhere. It's like a mirror which is really empty of images. It's free from all marks of objects of mind, and it has nothing to reveal in itself. All things appear in it, but none of the defiled things are able to defile it. For the essence of wisdom, original enlightenment, is unaffected by defilements. It's the eternally abiding one mind. So this is kind of Zen sounding, but this is this, you know, supposedly Indian treatise, but probably really written in China. Francis Cook, by the way, he says, the Indian Buddhist tradition was this very gradual approach, and the sudden thing was only in China. But I just want to, you know, put in an addendum that there are Indian traditions around the time when Zen was starting in China, that are more like sudden teachings, like Mahamudra is Indian teaching of Tilopa and Naropa. And they were into like almost the same as Zen. Like, this is already the case, we just have to wake up to it. An Advaita Vedanta was also non-dual and therefore sudden or imminent. Not Buddhist school, but yeah, Indian kind of sudden. And I think all the tantric schools of Indian practice and philosophy were also kind of like sudden non-dual emphasis. And that's Indian. But none of them are like mainstream Indian Buddhism. So my geeky nature couldn't help. As I mentioned yesterday, right, we were talking about Kensho and Satori and these different terms that Dogen uses. And I said, I think he uses probably, you know, Sho most and then maybe Satori some, and like we could turn on the computer sometime and check, and my geeky nature just couldn't help doing it. I didn't check email, but I just went to the Shobogenzo in digital form and plugged in these characters so you can see how many times they appear in the Shobogenzo. So this is, I don't know if this is, if anybody's done this search yet. It's easy. It's a PDF file of the entire Shobogenzo in Japanese, and you just do find, right? And when you have to plug in the character, and it'll show you every place in the Shobogenzo, but it also shows you the count in the find window, right?
Yeah.
So, here's the results. You've all been waiting for the results. Yeah, I said yesterday, I think that Dogen uses these, I think maybe even Zen. Zen has many, many different words for enlightenment and awakening because it's such a central issue, like original face and the eyeball of the self and Genjo Koan and Jiju Zamai and all these things are, you know, names for, but maybe more standard specific names to translate Bodhi, really, or to emphasize this issue of awakening or enlightenment. Sho, which is used, like this morning we said, in the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it, doing one practice is practicing completely. Practice enlightenment is that shu-sho, and that sho is literally means verification or confirmation. And but there, right there, by Kaz Ta-Nehisi, got translated as enlightenment. And at lunch we chant, if practice and realization were two things, as it appears to an ordinary person, each could be recognized separately, that's the same, shu-sho. There, he translated it as realization, but I like to translate it as verification or confirmation. And because that's what Dogen, I think that's his favorite term for enlightenment, and that he uses the most.
Is verification.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, of all these terms, that was the winner.
Oh.
Yeah. Sho. People often translate it as realization. So, I said, sure, I bet he uses it at least 100 times. I bet you, right? And, yeah, that's what I said yesterday. But, so there's, in the Shobogenzo, Dogen's masterwork, there's 95 essays, right? No, there's 95 fascicles, chapters of the Shobogenzo. Each one's like, 5 to 10 pages average, right? So, 100 would be like one per, average one per essay. What do you think?
Yeah.
No, I know, not that high. I mean, he's got some other things he wants to talk about too. Anyway, of these, enlightenment terms, Sho was the winner, 446 times in the Shobo Genzo, which I guess would average 3 or 4 per fascicle, but I think some of them might have it a lot more, some less. But wow, he loves that one. I think it's not that many other Zen people or sutras use this term, as I understand it. So we can really understand it as kind of like a Dogen trademark term for, I'm sure it's used elsewhere, but he uses it a lot. He also uses Genjo a lot, which means manifesting or actualizing. And I think that's really part of Dogen Zen. I think it's nice to know this, because when we're talking about awakening here, we're just confirming or verifying what is already the case. I think that's why he uses it. If we say practice and enlightenment, it has a little different flavor. If we say practice and verification, understanding that we mean verification of reality, Buddha nature, truth. Anyway, the second place in terms of Dogen's names for
the
Dora Prize for enlightenment is Satori, or Go, as in the other reading, Daigo. This essay called Great Satori has a bunch of them in it, of course, but it's all over, like today, also in the Genjo Koan, when those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas, that's those who have great Satori about delusion are Buddhas. So it's in there, and I think it might be in the GTU's MI too. But any guesses on this one? No, it's not so far behind Sho. Sho is 446. Go, or Satori, is 372. Dogen was into the Satori issue. That's a lot, 372 times. The third place is not far behind, is this other term.
The bronze medal.
The bronze medal, Kaku, which is also, in Japanese pronunciation, is also Satori. But it's not, it's instead of go in the Chinese pronunciation, it's kaku. And they both mean to understand, to realize, even like to perceive, or, I think to realize or understand is kind of the general meaning. Kaku has that meaning and also means awakening, literally. So I think it's maybe the most accurate character to use for Bodhi, awakening. Yeah, and Kaku in the Shobo Genzo was a close third, 337. So almost as many as Satori, but not quite. And the fourth word we talked about yesterday was Kensho. And as I mentioned, Dogen, I think, was not so into this word, and I wanted to kind of confirm that before I, make such a public statement. So, no, this is like, this was kind of surprising.
32.
Wow.
Not a single mention of Kensho?
No, there are some, but 11.
Wow.
11, and, but then I kind of looked at where they were, went to the English of the fascicles, and basically every one of these 11 times, except for maybe one that's just a random quote of one of the ancestors that wasn't really the point of the quote, it was just sort of in there because it was a very popular phrase in Chinese Zen. Genjo was used all the time, and in Rinzai Zen too. But all these other, I think maybe the 10 other times that it's used, each one is used for the Dogen is criticizing it.
I knew it.
He's really, I was surprised. He gives it like no credit.
The definition that the Chinese have given it? The dualistic nature of trying to achieve a specific experience.
Yeah, I think he understands, and probably this has something to do with his community, which was a bunch of Rinzai people coming into the community, that it's, I don't think it's inherently an improper term, but I think Dogen's understanding is that it could be interpreted dualistically, like show or nature. This is different than the other show, right? This is like nature, as in Buddha nature, is something to see. I think that's what Dogen didn't like about it, as opposed to it's something to be and to confirm. So we might say, well, isn't that getting a little nitpicky? If Dogen's so into this confirmation, verification, isn't that kind of like seeing? But maybe not. Maybe the nuance a little different. It's not like, I see this truth, but more like, I confirm it in my very being. Confirmation doesn't really have the dualistic flavor that seeing has, I think, just in English, right? Confirmation is, I'm confirming it with my whole body and mind. It's not like I'm intellectually confirming it. Like my whole being is verifying non-duality, or I'm actualizing the fundamental point. I'm manifesting or expressing it. And Dogen was really into expressing and manifesting, living it, rather than just like, I don't have to live anything, but I just have to see that. So, in Mountains and Waters Sutra, he brings it up once and criticizes it, Kensho. In Bukyo, which is Buddha's teaching essay, he criticizes it. And in the monk in the fourth jhana, that I mentioned yesterday, that essay, that one he really, really starts railing on it. And as I said, this term, I think, comes from the Platform Sutra. Maybe the first time. Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. And Dogen even says, it is in there if you look at the Chinese of the Platform Sutra, but Dogen says in this essay, he says, Huineng, the Sixth Ancestor, did not say Kensho. Oh. This is an apocryphal text, not to be relied on. Oh. Or somebody, he's one of our ancestors, so he's not like Huineng was wrong, but like whoever put that together did it wrong. I don't know, he had a bone to pick about Kensho.
Like whoever the translator was,
that's what, or apocryphal, meaning like people added on pieces to the original Platform Sutra. It kind of implies in that essay that the whole Platform Sutra is not really Huineng's teaching, although it's such an important Zen teaching. Yes. Yeah, hopefully we're verifying something. If we're still here after a few days, something's probably being verified. Even if you can't see it, right? Can't see it as some thing. Of course, it's, show is not something to see anyway, really. But yeah. Yeah, it's always been the case. Although in our point in the story here of Shakyamuni Buddha, he's off by himself. But after he was Buddha, within a few weeks, he was virtually never alone again. I think Keizan says it like, after the Buddha's awakening, he didn't have a single day when he wasn't like practicing with the Sangha. I think in the old sutras they said he took some vacations, where he went off alone, but almost never. he really was like offering his life to everyone, and the Sangha was practicing together, and he said we should practice in Sangha together, and we practice and verify the way together. Indeed, here we are together again. So, excuse me for the geekiness. Today we have a new story from Dogen in Great Satori Fascicle Daigo about Great Master Bao Zhi of Huayan Monastery in Jingzhou, descended from a Dharma heir of Dongshan, our ancestor, called, and his other name is called Xu Jing. So he's got all these names. He's a disciple of Dongshan, Tozan Ryokai. And here's a prequel story to this, to Dogen's story about Xu Jing. When he was still training as a novice priest, he was the Eno. I'm not sure if it was at Dongshan's place or where, but he was the Eno. And the Eno, I guess, in those days in that small community was also the work leader. So he struck the work meeting han, the signal for work meeting, or he rang the little bell. When the assembly gathered, he said, "Those who sit on the right side of the zendo, please gather some firewood, and those who sit on the left side of the zendo can work in the garden today." And the shuso said, "Excuse me, Xu Jing, work leader, what about Manjushri, who sits in the center of the hall, right? He doesn't sit on the right or the left side." And even in those days, they had Manjushri in the center of the zendo, right? And Xu Jing replied, "He's not seated on either side, so where is them for him to go? Where is there for him to go? Where is there for him to go?" That's a story. I don't know if anyone realized Great Awakening there, but that's a kind of like young Xu Jing, had that encounter was recorded about him when he was, you know, later when he's teaching, the emperor, of the latter Tang Dynasty invited him to the palace for a vegetarian feast, and a bunch of other Zen teachers were there too. And they were all reading and chanting the sutras, maybe as what they do when they come to lunch with the emperors. They read sutras and then kind of dedicate the merit to the emperor, probably, and then get a meal. Master Xu Jing and his little sangha that came with him to lunch,
entourage.
Yeah, they just sat there silently while all the other Zen people were chanting sutras around. And the emperor said, "Why don't you read sutras like these other people?" And Xu Jing said, "When the way is easy, we don't pass along the imperial command. During prosperous, peaceful times, we stop singing the song of great peace." So I think he's talking to the emperor, but I think by imperial command here, he means like, our emperor, the Buddha. When the way is peaceful, we don't pass along the Buddha's commands from the sutras. And the way is peaceful here, so kind of we don't need those Buddha words. I think it's the meaning here. Yeah. And the emperor said, "For you not to read the sutras may be all right, but what about your entourage here? why don't they read the sutras either? Like if you've gone beyond Buddhist teachings, you don't need to read them, but shouldn't they all read them? Their training is to understand the teaching, right? And Xu Jing said, in a lion's den, there's no other kinds of animals. Where the elephant walks, there's no fox tracks. Kind of like, we're all kind of beyond that now. Our whole group, we just sit. And in self-fulfilling samadhi and just enjoy the true self. The emperor said, well, what about all these other great teachers around here? Why are they reading the sutras then? Uh-oh. Xu Jing said, jellyfish have no eyes. In seeking food, they must depend on prawns. Weird, huh? Prawns. Prawns. Like little, yes. So, I thought it might be more like they, that the prawn, I don't know really how jellyfish and prawns interact, but I was picturing it more like the prawns are kind of are going to where the food is.
They just slide right open and they go right to their stomach. They don't have to throw anything.
The prawns just come in and they then the jellyfish
go. Oh, okay.
So they're not seeking.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or yeah. Mm-hmm. In seeking food, they must depend on prawns. It's going to be fed to them. Like that. That sounds right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The emperor was delighted. These are just some background stories about Xu Jing, who we're about to hear Dogen's story now. That one was from the verse commentary to the Book of Serenity, case number 3. Now here's today's story in Shobogenzo Daigo. This teacher, Xu Jing, the disciple of Dongshan, was once asked by a monk, how is it when a person of great awakening, when a person of daigo, a person of great satori, returns to delusion? Sounds familiar? What about when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? Or how is it when a person of great realization returns to delusion? And Xu Jing said, a broken mirror does not reflect again. Fallen flowers cannot climb back up onto the tree. So they talk this way, right? It's like, I think you could hear it in different ways, but it's an unusual metaphor.
Embracing all oneness is Buddha nature, and Buddha nature includes everything, kind of response.
Well, I would see it as today, as we talk a lot about the mirror as this metaphor for non-dual awareness, right? But I think in this story, it's a different mirror metaphor. The mirror's not referring to non-dual awareness, but the mirror is referring to dualistic consciousness that knows objects. That's my proposition about this story. That the mirror, and sometimes mirror is used this way in the teachings of like actually this morning in the Genjo Koan, unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, like things in the reflections in the mirror, when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. I think there also Dogen's using the mirror as like there's something and then it's a reflection. There's a reflection that's separate from the reality. It's a distortion. There's the reality and then there's a reflection. Or the subject is different from the object. Something like this, I think, in this mirror metaphor. That's right. The mirror is broken. The dualistic mirror, in this case, the mirror where there's reflecting illusions outside of itself. The mirror in which the viewer and the view are separate, something like this, is broken, and a broken mirror never reflects again. That would be like a positive thing, exactly, a positive thing. That the broken mirror is like the enlightened person no longer ever has dualistic perception.
And the flower.
And the flower we could hear is like... Yeah. Well, at least we heard that this morning too in the Ginjo Koan, right? We could hear it here as the flowers of all our habitual tendencies that make us nice and shiny, but they're kind of like extra. And all that extra stuff just falls away, like dropping off body and mind. The flowers of old stale patterns have withered and fallen. And there's how is it when all the leaves fall, the body exposed in the golden wind, like that, like there's just the bare, pure tree.
So is he saying that it's someone who is awakening cannot fall back into the illusion?
They can't climb back up onto the tree. Yeah, that's right.
But that question on the tree the question is what happens when a awakened person falls into the illusion and says that can't happen.
They're not awakened.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. As I mentioned earlier, the Indian Buddhist model of awakening, even all these stages, the stream enter, the once returner, the non-returner, the ahat, each stage is irreversible. There's this issue of irreversibility, and you can't go back on the tree. You can't, once this some insight has happened, it is never forgotten, although it's at these stages like stream enter. Remember, stream enter still has greed and hate, because my understanding is that greed and hate would arise when they've forgotten, temporarily forgotten their insight that there's no separate self, because the habit is so deep. It's like you can see it once, but it's like the habit's going to come back because it's got a lot of momentum. That's my understanding of the Indian model. You can realize it, and you only have 7 more lifetimes because you can't forget it completely, but you can temporarily forget that you're not an experiencer of your body and mind. And you can, especially if somebody insults you or triggers you, you fall back into, what do you mean? I'm the experiencer here. Don't say that to me. So because the habit's strong, especially in trying situations. But the basic insight, it's not like, I think the stream enter, my understanding is that they wouldn't be like, what was that again? Like, I don't know about that now. It sounded good in the past, but like, I don't know. It's more like, no, I'm convinced. Like, I can't be talked out of it. But there's a lot of work to do still. See how that's a kind of irreversibility. And this story kind of implies that, I think. Is but Dogen's going to tear it apart. So the story is, how is it when a person of great awakening returns to delusion? And Xu Jing says, a broken mirror never reflects again, and fallen flowers can't go back onto the tree. Yeah, it's like they don't, they're never really deluded again, maybe we could say. It doesn't say how that plays out, what that would look like in an awakened person's life when they get insulted, for example. It doesn't get into that. It just, there's some, it seems like there's something about some change of, permanent change of state or something, right? So Dogen says, this question may be a question, but it's like a statement to the assembly. It could only be expounded in the assembly of Huayan, Xu Jing. It could only be bestowed by a legitimate successor of Dongshan. Truly, this must be the proper seat of a Buddha, an ancestor who has studied his fill. So, Dogen's praising this answer, but then he's going to, like, you know, dissect it a little bit, or, you know, understand it in his own way. So now Dogen says, the person of great awakening here does not mean someone who has great awakening from the beginning. So that's maybe one of the hardest statements he makes, because we might say, isn't that kind of what we're talking about, this born knowing and so on? But I think one way we could hear this is, person of great awakening does not mean someone who has great awakening from the beginning. Right? That's maybe the problem. It's not something that someone has. But it's also not someone, this person of great awakening, is not someone who stores up a great awakening from somewhere else. I think that's kind of like, they attain it from somebody else. They get it from elsewhere. So it's neither something they've always had, nor is it something that they get from somewhere. Great awakening is not something that, though present in the public realm, one only encounters at last in old age. It's kind of a weird statement, but maybe something that's always around in the public realm that is available to everyone, but one only encounters it in one's later years. Something like that. So it's not something one forcibly pulls out of oneself, this great awakening. And sometimes, like in the Nirvana Sutra, they talk about Buddha nature is like a hidden jewel within, and we'd have to discover it. Even that's a little bit like, it's something inside us that we pull out. And it's a little bit dualistic. It's not something inside our body or mind that is can be pulled out and say, here's the jewel. It's not anything-ification of this great awakening is problematic. Nevertheless, Dogen says, the person of great awakening invariably greatly awakens.
It's the day.
Yeah, we're celebrating great awakening here. We're just trying to make sure we don't fall into any of these ways of misunderstanding it. We need not suppose that in order... it's not that great awakening is not being deluded. Like, that's actually a key sentence. It's not that... It's not that great awakening is not being deluded. Those are like a duality. And it kind of sounds like that in the original story. We might interpret the broken mirror never shines again. It's like there's no more delusion. This is great awakening as opposed to delusion. And it sounds like that's the early Buddhist model, right? We're stuck in samsara and we have to realize we're stuck in conditioned samsara of birth and death. We have to realize nirvana, the unconditioned freedom from samsara. Like they're opposed, opposites. But in the Genjo Koan, maybe that's what this is looking for, we chanted this morning, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. That's Dogen. And it's
Dogen
often does sound backwards, I think. And it's, I think that's, those sentences are closely related to this essay and this sentence. So it's nice that you picked up on that. And it's the same terms. Daigo, a great Satori, and Mei, or delusion, is like the opposite, the ignorance, or I think that character is, translates like the Sanskrit vimoha. Bodhi and vimoha are ignorance or delusion. So those who have great realization of delusion have great satori about delusion are Buddhas. And those who are greatly deluded about satori are sentient beings. So Dogen's helping us to not be deluded about satori, and this whole essay is kind of all the ways that we could be deluded about awakening. But I think an even more radical statement is those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. In other words, those who really understand what delusion is. And we and see this is delusion, but I understand what delusion is. I understand that it's an appearance arising due to dualistic perception, but that that's not really how things are. Yes.
If we really understand the depth of that, can be deeply compassionate towards ourselves and others, which doesn't mean that we say that's okay, we can just all be deluded, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not saying that. It's
mm-hmm.
Deeply enough to see it and not turn away from it.
Yes. Yes. We see the awesome power of delusion to cause great havoc on ourselves and others in this world, right? All great havoc, I would say, is caused by delusion, at least human havoc. We humbly bow to delusion, and we better take good care of it, because if we don't, and if we don't understand it, then it can really take over and destroy everything, at least seem to. So Dogen's always, emphasizing non-duality. The early Buddhist teachings are a little bit like, enlightenment is not so much an issue of realizing non-duality. You can maybe find little hints in the early sutras about that, but it's more about ending greed, hate, and all the kleshas, and the delusion the issue of anatman, no independent, separate, personal self, is a key part of the early teachings of awakening, but that's not really non-duality. We could make a case for how it's related. If there's a separate self, then that's going to grasp other objects. But it's not really framed that way. Whereas Zen, especially Dogen Zen, is like awakening is not so much about ending greed, hate, and delusion, as it is realizing the non-duality of realization and delusion. But without mixing them all together, as Nettie's saying, without saying, well, then it's all the same, so it doesn't matter. That's not it. But that the nature of delusion is empty suchness. And if we come to see that more and more while honoring its power to manifest in very harmful ways, we can start to our own reification of this delusion can start to decrease, and therefore we can cause less havoc. So it's not the great awakening is not being deluded. They're not opposites. Yeah, in the merging of difference and unity, right? Sekitoki Sen says, according with principle, which is kind of like true essence as opposed to phenomena, according with principle is still not Satori, right? Still not enlightenment. It's the same term, Satori. So it's not just a matter of this one-sided issue of the principle of emptiness. The merging of difference and unity is like all the expressions and dualistic appearances are in unity with the one unchanging suchness. And just according with the one unchanging suchness that eliminates delusion, that's still not Satori. Sekitoki Sen says, right? Dogen says, we need not suppose that in order to be the seedling for great awakening, we ought to first become deluded. And one interpretation of this is like a bodhisattva coming into the world to help others, like in the Lotus Sutra, this lost son and the father, who's the kind of like the Buddha in this parable, sees the son and puts on beggar's rags like the son in order to kind of like meet the son where he's at. It's kind of like the enlightened one coming into delusion to meet them. So I think Dogen's saying it's not really actually becoming deluded in order to help others. It's to be the seedling for great awakening, maybe, is to plant the seed of great awakening for others. It's not that we need to first become deluded. One way to hear this. The person of great awakening goes on greatly to awaken. The person of great delusion goes on greatly to awaken. So we include both sides of all our petty habits and all that stuff we could call delusion is that one. This one that's like sits here in Sashin with our resistances and qualms and doubts and confusion and all of that. That one is realizing awakening. What?
Preferences.
Piles of preferences, and if we call that the deluded one, then that one's in great awakening, or goes on greatly to awaken. Just as is the person of great awakening, there's the Buddha of great awakening. There are earth, water, fire, wind, and space of great awakening. So now we're back into like, all these appearances are part of this great awakening too. That's where, when we talked then about, it sounds like another name for Buddha nature that includes everything. It sounds like this.
Earth, grass, walls,
Mm-hmm.
Where the Buddhist world is going down this, has not helped the planet avoid this, or human species in Buddhist countries has the same delusion about not being good.
Hmm. Yeah, everybody in the world's not taking very good care of the planet.
Yeah.
We could be doing a lot better. Well, but I would just, you know, also bring up the other side of it. I think that, what we say, earth, grass, balls, tiles, and pebbles, like in the GDUZMI, and we don't mention animals. I think, I mean, I've often thought, what's that? I think it's because animals were obviously included in as sentient beings, always in Buddhism. And there was a kind of dividing line between animals and vegetables were not considered sentient in the Indian tradition. So I think, like the Nirvana Sutra going way back, all sentient beings, animals have Buddha nature, but in that sutra the Buddha says, what doesn't have Buddha nature is rocks, tiles, walls, and pebbles. And so it's a Zen new inclusive thing to include grasses, rocks, tiles, and that I think that animals are mentioned because that's already obvious. To defend Dogen a little bit there. Yeah, it was this new thing of the teaching of the non-sentient in Zen in China. And so we already knew that about the teaching of the sentient, which included animals. And I think it depends on the country, right? But a lot of Asian Buddhist countries, at least East Asia, like China, Korea, Japan, traditionally was like Buddhist lay people and monastics were vegetarian, devout ones, for centuries and centuries. I think it's kind of recently changed in Japan, Buddhism became kind of secularized and they kind of lost that one a little. But also there's these animal liberation ceremonies that nowadays we might say it might be problematic, but I think the spirit in all of these Mahayana countries, I think Theravada countries too, of releasing captive animals that would be killed in large amounts and, you know, large mammals and stuff even. So that's in there. But well, but we can all do better at taking care of animals, plants, and minerals on this planet for sure. So there are earth, water, fire, wind, and space of great awakening, and dogs, cats, chickens, and pigs of great awakening, goats. There are columns and lanterns of great awakening. I think that's like the scenery of the Dharma Hall where Dogen's giving the talk, often has these pillars in the hold up the roof and the lanterns on the altar. So it's kind of like all this stuff around us is there are the columns and lanterns of great awakening. Here they are being questioned as the person of great awakening. The question, what about when the person of great awakening returns to delusion, is truly asking what should be asked. This ancestor, Huayan, does not reject it. He emulates the ancients in the monastic seat. His is the meritorious deed of a Buddha and ancestor. I think this is an interesting conversation to continue, which Dogen will continue for a while. Most of the rest of this essay is on this story about how is it when a greatly awakened one returns to delusion. So it's all about now the relationship of delusion and awakening. This kind of subtle relationship. May our intent
intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.